From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Yesterday was crossover day at the state capitol. That is when bills must be clear of one chamber or the other to remain in play for the rest of the legislative session. Lawmakers do have some ways to get around that rule, but for the most part, crossover day is do-or-die time. The Senate was in session until 7 yesterday evening, and the House stayed until 11 p.m. Both chambers passed a wave of legislation by the deadline. Here is Representative Ed Setzler of Ackworth describing one of the most controversial, an abortion bill.
But this is an opportunity for us to debate and talk about the very meaning of human life and those that are worthy of our state's protection.
Joining me now in the studio are two reporters who I hope crossed over into some sleep last night, but I'm kind of doubting it. One is our regular Friday morning guest, GPB politics reporter Stephen Fowler. Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. And also with us, Donna Lowry. She's Capitol correspondent for GPB TV's Lawmakers, and welcome to you.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, let's begin with the biggest story from last night. The House did pass a bill that would tighten restrictions on women seeking abortions. This was by a vote of 93-73, passed after an emotionally tense debate for more than 90 minutes. Let's hear a little of that.
And I have heard from obstetricians who practice in this state and genuinely do not want to be criminalized for caring for women in our state for what they do.
That was Republican Representative Deborah Silcox, a Republican again from Sandy Springs, voted against the bill. Stephen, this was not a party line vote. What was the debate like on the House floor?
Well, Virginia, it was late in the evening. It was around 10 o'clock when the debate started. And really, it was a very, very tense, emotional debate, like you said. It started off with several House Democrats, more than a dozen or so, standing up and physically turning around while Representative Setzler, the bill's sponsor, was speaking. Some of them were holding coat hangers to symbolize unsafe in-home abortions that would happen if this bill passed, so they say. And really, it was a tense moment. The Speaker of the House demanded that they have some decorum and turn around. Eventually, they did. But there were still tense moments of the debate. We had representatives come up, speak for the bill. One read a story about a baby fetus and how the baby fetus was going to vote for the bill, and so was she. You had a representative who was delivering the minority report from the Democrats who said, kept going past her time and eventually had her mic cut from the things. And so this was a very, very emotional debate. You heard Representative Silcox there, you know, in tears sharing her debate. So, you know, there was very loaded language used from both sides of the aisle and both sides of this issue debate in talking about this bill before it was eventually passed.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the bill itself. Donna, we've heard the term heartbeat bill used to describe the legislation. Can you unpack that language for us a little? What kind of changes would be made to the existing law?
Well, it would ban abortion after a fetal heartbeat is detected. And a fetal heartbeat can be found as early as 6 weeks by medical professionals, although they say it is actually it's actually there before then. And that's before many women even know they are pregnant. So it is called the Living Infants Fairness Equality Act, LIFE, and it would prohibit abortions after that point, which would dramatically restrict abortions in Georgia, where right now it's the 20th week of pregnancy. You can have an abortion up to that point.
Now, this would be one of the most restrictive in the country, although Georgia not the only state making legislative changes to abortion laws. This week, the Tennessee House passed a similar heartbeat bill, and Rhode Island's House voted to codify Roe v. Wade into state law. So, how does this Georgia bill fit into the national conversation?
Well, what you're seeing is a lot of states taking action to stake their flag in the ground regarding the abortion debate in hopes that one way or the other, this decision will make its way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. You have this heartbeat bill, which is one of the most restrictive laws in the country. If it passes here and is signed into law here in Tennessee and other states, and then on the other end, you have states saying no, Roe versus Wade is the law of the land. So eventually, what you're going to see is this most likely go to the U.S. Supreme Court, and with the recent appointment of Justice Brett Kavanaugh, it's widely expected that this could be overturned. And that was another bill that Republicans put forth in the House that didn't make it to crossover day, but a proposal from Governor Brian Kemp would have said if that's overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court, then Georgia would immediately overturn abortion and effectively outlaw it.
What did we hear from Governor Kemp yesterday, Donna?
He was very happy about this. He pushed for the trigger law that Stephen just mentioned, which would have triggered all abortions to end if Roe versus Wade is overturned. But he was happy for anything. You know, he said during his campaign that he was going to sign the toughest abortion laws in the country, and this is a move in that direction. So he had a press conference at this past 15 minutes later at 11:15 p.m. He had a press conference to basically said he was happy about this, is moving in the right directions. A direction, of course, his base is probably very happy at this point.
Well, another issue that has become a flashpoint, the hate crimes bill. Georgia is one of five states that does not currently have such a bill. But yesterday, the House passed a bill that could change that. Donna, what kind of protections are offered in this bill?
It's protections for everything from race, religion, creed, the LGBT community, all of that. And it is considered very monumental for Georgia because 45 states already have hate crime bills, and Georgia's one of the ones that doesn't. So this is a move in that direction. It received pretty good support last night. It didn't look at first like it was going to make it, but they went for it, and there was a lot of cheering. That was before, of course, the abortion bill. So it was a very emotional night of roller coaster feelings.
Well, Stephen, last night the House did only vote it down against two bills. They both dealt with health care. What got shot down?
So, yeah, over the course of the night between the two chambers, there were close to 90 bills that were voted on. In the Senate, two of them were tabled. In the House, two of them failed. And these two both deal with health care, like you said. One would have overhauled the Certificate of Need program, which is this requirement for health care facilities that if they want to open up a new facility or do something, that they would have to get this Certificate of Need that shows that they, you know, needed to be there. And this was hopefully the sponsors of the bill wanted this to do something to kind of help rural health care and help things in rural Georgia. But it wasn't enough because several lawmakers were worried about what that would do to their hospitals and their things like that. And the sponsor of the bill, Representative Matt Hatchett, said, you know, it will be back, that he was down, but they didn't count the 10. And so the CON bill could be one of those things that continues after the session, but most likely pared down a lot. And the other bill that didn't make it that was somewhat of a surprise was surprise billing. And this was a measure in the House that dealt with surprise bills sent to patients who thought that they were covered by insurance. That failed 77 to 78. But the Senate did pass their own version of surprise billing legislation, so that concept and issue will still be discussed.
That's not going away. That's GPB Politics reporter Stephen Fowler. Also with me, GPB Lawmakers reporter Donna Lowry. Both somehow awake to talk about yesterday's marathon session at the state capitol during crossover day. Another bill would allow the state to take over operation of the Hartsfield-Jackson Airport in Atlanta, now heading to the House after clearing the Senate last night. The city of Atlanta is not going to let it go easily. And Donna, you had a sit-down interview with the Atlanta mayor, Keisha Lance Bottoms, last week. Let's just hear a little bit of what she had to say.
The state's had its own challenges. When the state's had challenges with procurement with some of our university partners, there was not a call for the Federal Department of Education to come in and take over. When the state has had any number of ethical allegations, there's not been a call for the feds to step in and take over.
Donna, why did Republicans pass this bill, and why is the city so opposed?
Yeah, well, Republican Burt Jones is the one who pushed this. He had a commission last year that looked into this, and basically it has to do with corruption at City Hall, mismanagement. We had an indictment this week that we heard about, and the feeling that the city isn't doing a good job when it comes to running the airport. Of course, on the other end, the mayor calls this an act of war. She is upset and vehemently opposed to anybody taking over the airport. She actually pointed fingers more so, as you heard, toward the state and said that they wouldn't do a better job of this. The other thing that came into play was that we've had this happen in Charlotte, mm-hmm. and where North Carolina tried to take over the airport in Charlotte in 2013, went into protracted litigation, and in the end, Charlotte is still running the airport. There's still some litigation going on. So this is two sides really putting their stick in the sand and saying, hey, listen, we are going to stick with where we want to be. We're yet to hear how the governor feels about this, right. I think, too.
So the FAA, he says he's just keeping an eye on it, I think.
That's it.
Sticking with the Senate, Donna, one notable piece of legislation that did not advance this week, a bill dealing with school vouchers. What did lawmakers reject, and how does that square with the larger push for legislators to address education?
That's interesting. School vouchers is what the opponents call it. The people who are for it call it school choice. And it is a matter of having money that would go into the public schools be used in private schools for kids who may have been bullied, who they talked a little bit about kids who have special needs, but kids who want another choice in schools. The money is the big issue. It could be up to about $500 million. And so that's the big problem with it. But it could go toward tuition, textbooks. It could be going toward therapy for kids. And it did not pass. We thought it might come back up again last night. It did not. But we know that this fight is not over and that both sides are ready to fight in this one, too.
Stephen, other bills, big or small, that did not make the cut to Crossover Day?
Well, you know, there are over 500 bills filed in the House so far this session, and the Senate has well over 200. So there are plenty of things that didn't make it. But some of the notable ones in the Senate, there was this measure, Racinos or paramutual betting or horse racing or the Rural Jobs Growth Act, as it was officially titled, whatever you want to call it, that did not make it up for consideration and discussion. The bill's sponsor, Senator Brandon Beach, is running for U.S. Congress next year, so maybe that's something fallen by the wayside, or it could be something that makes its way in at the end of the session. But that was a big one that didn't pass. Also, the Equal Rights Amendment, it was big at the beginning of the session in the Senate, with Georgia potentially being the 35th state to do that. That didn't make it. And, you know, there are dozens of other bills, big and small, that didn't find their way through.
So, quickly, we've got to wrap, but, you know, do or die day, that's what they say. But there are ways the bills can rise from the dead after crossover days so that we might see them again. How might that happen?
Well, so if you take a look at some of the bills that did pass, they're kind of generic or kind of vague or kind of dealing with things that you didn't even know were things. Some of those may be vehicles to be cannibalized by other bills that didn't make it that maybe have the same code section. So if there's a generic tax bill, that could be replaced by a controversial tax bill. Or if there's a generic, you know, horse bill, maybe the horse racing bill goes in there. And it's also just kind of a handshake agreement, because if the leadership wants something and the Governor Kemp wants something, they will find ways to make it work in either the House or the Senate. So, you know, nothing is dead until day 40. And even then, this is the first year of the biennial session. So anything that doesn't pass this session is automatically back on the table when we start again next January.
Well, and you guys are back at it today, Stephen Fowler and Donna Lowry. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
GPB politics reporter Stephen Fowler and Donna Lowry, Capitol correspondent for GPB's Lawmakers. Crossover Day will, of course, be the subject of Political Rewind show today at 2. You can watch it on Facebook Live. You can podcast it later. It's going to be posted right after the show. Bill and his guests are going to spend an hour with news and analysis, so stay with GPB for that. But coming up for us, people who don't normally interact sit down for frank conversations about race on camera. We're going to talk to two participants from Macon Conversations. I'm Virginia Prescott. Stay with us for more on Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. GPB series Macon Conversations brings together folks who have frank conversations about race. Participants come from different backgrounds and find common ground.
We have to be willing to listen and try to put ourselves in other people's shoes. And it's impossible to fully do that, but you're certainly never going to be able to do that if you don't sit down and talk.
It's interesting to hear you say and like come from that perspective, because a lot of times it feels like people who are marginalized are the ones who are always like, oh my God, like we have to wave the flag on these things. And sometimes it doesn't feel that people that don't share our lived experiences actually understand that.
Tanja Kabir and Katie Powers participated in Macon Conversations. Tanja is executive director of the Griffith Family Foundation, which provides grants to programs in the Macon community. And Kate is founder of Macon Book'em. It's a nonprofit that provides books to at-risk kids. And they're joining me now both from our studios in Macon. Welcome.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for being here. Question, did you know, I'm going to ask you to start with Tanja, did you know each other before you got to that studio in Macon that day?
No, I didn't. And it's weird because I do know a lot of people outside of my background, but I had never met Katie before the conversation.
So people who don't normally interact are the people that join these Macon conversations. How were you approached for the conversation, Tanja?
Honestly, I got a Facebook message from the producer.
Saying, all starts with Facebook.
Would you like to participate in this conversation? I said, oh, okay, sure. Sounds great.
Katie, how about for you?
So I have been a fan of the Macon Conversation series. And like Tanja, I got a Facebook message. And when they asked, I jumped at the chance. So I was thrilled and honored to be asked.
So you were asked, but then how about right there when you're in the studio or the green room waiting for that conversation? How did you feel then?
Nervous.
Yes.
I felt very nervous. I was like, okay, I did sign up for this, but exactly, you know, what am I going to say? And most importantly, how am I going to say it? How am I going to present myself? Because a lot of times, like I said in the clip, it's Black people talking about race, and it's you know, I didn't want to be seen as the angry Black woman or, you know, someone who's complaining about something. So I really wanted to make sure that I brought my genuine self, but also I didn't want it to, you know, I cared about how it was perceived.
Yeah. How about you, Katie?
Same. And you know, I wanted to hopefully appear genuine and candid and most of all not condescending in any way. And I really just had to remind myself going into it, I need to listen. Listen and hear and see.
I think a lot of people don't have these conversations because they're afraid of just the things you guys are talking about. Don't want to say the wrong thing. Don't want to sound, you know, like I don't know what I'm talking about. This edited conversation did end up being about 10 minutes, but y'all talked for almost an hour. Among the topics discussed, defining what racism is, and you didn't actually agree on a definition. Tanja, how did you define it for this conversation?
I talked about it more from the systematic perspective, looking at just this idea that racism is really about the norms and the actions that consistently provide an advantage for white people, simultaneously making it disadvantages for people of color.
And what do you think for you, Katie?
Well, racism as a way, a point of view, seeing another person or race of people as, you know, subpar or less than, whatever your race is, just grouping, lumping a group of people into a category that makes it easy for you to make judgments about them.
So system and attitudes. Here's just a clip about from the actual program about how race impacts your experiences.
I always have to think about my race. I always have to think about who I am. How did I show up to the room, you know? Are people going to think a certain way of me because of the color of my skin? Do you think a lot about what your whiteness means for you?
You know, I don't, I mean, I guess the only thing that I have to worry about is as a female, you know, and a blonde, you know, being maybe stereotyped as ditzy or and sort of have to prove myself in that way.
So this gets to identity. It gets to, you know, what you're representing when you're walking into the room. Katie, since having this conversation with Tanja, have you thought about what that means differently?
I have. And, you know, before the conversation, I really thought that I was pretty aware of other people's experience, and but it really has made me think more, especially at events where there may be, you know, a variety of people from different races, and
just to watch the interactions, and it's really made me try to put myself in other people's shoes more, which I think we could all do a bit more of.
You said events, you both work in the nonprofit sector, so you're probably crossing into the same rooms. But how do you navigate these ideas of who might feel welcome or unwelcome in a room? I'll put that to you, Tanja.
Pretty much, I guess my thought process is I go into the room and I speak truth to power in the best ways that I know how to. But a lot of times you do have to have that conversation. In the space that we work in with Griffith Family Foundation, we look at poverty, and you can't say that you're going to tackle poverty. A nonprofit or philanthropic entity can't say that they're going to tackle poverty without looking at and understanding race and how that looks. And so it's definitely something that I think about. And showing up to the room as a Black person in this space, working with who I work with, it is important that I am Black, because there are certain levels that I'm able to identify with that other people may not be able to, and you need that voice and you need that understanding to be able to do that.
Let me ask you, are you often in the position of, you know, asking white people for money and for programs for, you know, people who are, what do we call them, marginalized communities, you know, all of those euphemisms that are used to disguise what might actually be going on?
Yes, I do, for the most part, from our end, I do tend to have to ask a lot of white people to think about race or to think about people outside of themselves. And it's never a difficult question, but when you ask people to sort of ponder and like, hey, you give the stats, like, yeah, poverty is serious and Macon is 27%, but 1/3 of that is Black versus 1/10 of that being white. So you have a 1/3 chance if you're Black of living in poverty in Macon. You really do have to ask people to kind of think outside of themselves to actually care about these issues and to work toward them as well.
Katie, how about for you? Your organization, Macon Bookum, brings you into contact with kids from different socioeconomic backgrounds than your own. How are you mindful when you are working with communities that might not look like you?
Sure. And my background is in teaching, and primarily in inner city Macon schools. And I think when I'm going into a school, which 3/4 of the children in Bibb County schools live below the poverty level, which is astounding, I think the children, children obviously see people more as people and don't have all the layers that adults sometimes do. So I'm fortunate in that way. And I'm showing up with books. So they quickly
they're really interested
the book
in you.
Lady. Right, right. So I have a really happy, fun job. But I'm also bringing law enforcement into the schools with me from the outreach department of the Bibb County Sheriff's Office. And it's been really interesting to hear their perspectives of just the mistrust from the community, and hearing parents even out in the community tell their children, oh, don't act up because, you know, they're going to arrest you. And obviously that's not the image they want to project. They want children to see them as their friends. And that's part of what we're trying to do as well, is build that sense of trust between law enforcement and these communities. So I don't know if I really answered your question. But yeah, I think it's easier for me because I'm mainly interacting with children.
I think there's no right answer there, but I really appreciate both of you sharing your experience. I'm speaking with Katie Powers and Tanja Kabir. They were both featured in a recent episode of GPB's Macon Conversation series. But I think that is an important thing to touch on, because you do, in the conversation, talk about police brutality, prejudice, discrimination, and stereotypes.
My brother, he has a full Arabic name, so obviously after 9/11, we couldn't travel through the airport together. And I mean, it's a privilege to be able to like mind your business in society, just to walk by and be yourself.
Well, so that's you, Tanja. Any worries about having these conversations with Katie, somebody you've never met? You know, you're not sure what her thoughts are, or you're not sure where she's coming from.
Definitely. I mean, there's a tiny little fear, but for me, I live by attempting to conquer my fears, not just with Katie, but just in general out in public with white people, in general with who I work with. Like, there is that fear, but I do understand, like Katie said earlier, if you don't have the conversation like this, we're not going to be able to resolve the issues that we're looking to address.
Do you have these kind of conversations about inclusion at the Griffith Family Foundation, you know, the board, the diversity of the grant recipients, all that?
We definitely do. In fact, we've adopted a social justice framework, which looks at things like capacity building, empowerment, and all of that comes through sort of a racial equity lens, or I should say a social equity lens. And so, yes, we definitely talk about how to ensure that our funds are diversified, but also on the boards that I sit on. I hope people don't hate me, but I am always talking about about race and saying, like, hey, it is important that we look at these things.
Well, you said that in the clip. You know, you feel like you're in the position of having to wave up and down and say, like, we need to talk about this, right?
Right.
And this is something that you also discussed in the conversation, privilege and what it means that, you know, you want people to talk about this, but a lot of people feel like, I just don't have to. Let's hear it.
The importance is to, first of all, know if you are privileged and recognize that and bring other people up to your level who should be there anyway.
I think that's important, bringing people with you. So when you walk into that room, it's not just you. In order for us to, like, actually move through the society together, if we're really about making a change, we have to be able to bring people with us into those rooms to kind of break those barriers down.
I'm wondering what you know, both of you are saying something, but a little differently. Katie, you said what you mean. You said bringing other people up to your level. And then, Tanya, you said bringing people with you as you go into a room. Have you thought about, you know, what this privilege means for you differently? And you even talked with the other people about it.
Sure, I'll go ahead. I think that it is important that if you come from a background where you're just born with certain advantages that other people don't have, whether they be you're born white, you are born into a family that has means and money and you have financial security, whether you have a sense of power from your family's position, that with that comes great responsibility. You know, I've just sort of lived by that creed that if you have these things, it is incumbent upon you to look at other people who may not have those advantages, and not out of a sense of pity or to say to them, you know, you're weaker than me, or come from that viewpoint at all, but just to say, I see you, and what can I do to help level the field, just level the field.
So what has the feedback been from your community, your friends, your family, since you've had this conversation, which was a couple weeks ago? I mean, are you, Katie, now in the position of saying, like we heard from Tanja earlier, are you the one who's saying, waving the flag and saying, we need to talk about this?
I guess, yes, and I've tried to be pretty vocal about it. I'm never one to... more by the power of the pen, I guess I'm pretty open about my viewpoints and beliefs. And I do think it's very important. And what I see, Virginia, from the white community is, and, you know, bringing up these issues and dialogue and trying to prompt dialogue is a fear of being shamed, I think, is really the biggest fear. The biggest things I hear, or the most common themes, are, well, you know, my parents didn't own slaves, or I'm not a racist. You know, I have two black friends or three black. You know, it's just, I don't know. I just want people to get it.
Well, you know what? I absolutely understand it. You know, as a white woman, that idea of like, oh, I'm going to say something stupid. And that is a space where we can go and exist together. And I'm wondering for you what that's felt like, Tanja. What has the feedback from your community been like?
Honestly, I can't say that I've thought about the feedback. I've been a little bit busy, but I'll say just generally this idea of social responsibility. One thing that I alluded to in the conversation was the idea that I'd love it for white people to continue to have these conversations amongst themselves.
That's
because
interesting.
It's so important, and I've been reading White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo, so it's definitely what she lays out. But being able to have that conversation is something, like, when I asked Katie, what does your whiteness mean for you? It's kind of like those are discussions that need to be had amongst white people, because in order to dismantle this system of racism, you really do have to, like, white people got to be doing it. Like, they got to be doing the work, right? And as black people, not to say that we don't have access to the system and that we can't do those things, but like I said, we're tired. We've been doing this. White people need to be having these conversations.
So a whole new chapter of making conversations, perhaps. Tanja Kabir, Executive Director of the Griffith Family Foundation. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Katie Power, she's founder of the nonprofit Macon Book M. Both of them join me from our Macon studios, and we do encourage you to watch Macon Conversations. They've been a great series. It is International Women's Day, and we're going to hear from a Georgia woman who busted through the glass gridiron and another who's helping bring the global challenges of women to dinner in homes across America, including Georgia. That's after the break. I'm Virginia Prescott. Stay with us. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today is International Women's Day. Let's recognize one Georgia high school football player who made history a few years ago and is still making history today. In 2016, Terrell Academy place kicker Jenna Cuff became the first female to be placed on the Georgia Independent Schools Association All-State football team. Now a senior at Terrell Academy in Dawson, Georgia, Jenna talked with GPB's John Nelson about her love for the sport.
Reason that I wanted to catch up with you is you are getting hardware and recognition for being a kicker at Terrell Academy in the GISA. First thing let me ask is, how did you get interested in wanting to be a place kicker for your high school football team?
Well, this whole story starts out with my dad. My dad, he coached arena football, and he was a kicker for the college that he went to at Albany State. And pretty much just growing up around football, it kind of just made me want to give it a try. I've always played soccer, and I'm not going to brag. I've had a big foot. And
nothing wrong with that.
I gave it a try after my coach even recommended it for me. He said, we need a kicker, so why don't you just try out? And so I did.
So when you got out there for the first time as a kicker, what was going through your mind as you're sitting there going, I'm actually going to do this? What was your thought process out there? What did you want to do that first time out of the blocks?
Well, I was pretty nervous because I didn't know if the team was going to accept me or not. But when I walked onto the field, they kind of cheered my name and it let things loose a little bit.
So to have that, I mean, because I know that there's that instant a bit of apprehension when you go out there in a situation like that, just because of the nature of a woman going out and being with men to do things. I guess as I try to think it through, did you think of yourself as doing something that was atypical, or did you just want to sit there and go out there and play football? What was going through your mind?
I've always played sports growing up. I've always played basketball, ran track. I played soccer, so it was pretty much just another sport to me. I didn't really even think of, oh, I'm a girl, this is a girl playing a boys' sport. I just went for it.
And I know that there are a lot of different times with girls playing, you know, guys' sports and things like that, that there are going to be guys giving you grief one way or the other, but it seems like your atmosphere down there at Terrell Academy was instant acceptance. How cool was that to see that from everybody else who was out there wearing football gear?
It was very helpful. I was very nervous, and the boys always supported me, and even the coaches. The coaches would always support me, and Coach Murdoch, my head football coach, he was the one that told me, hey, you need to come out and try and kick for us, and that was my eighth grade year in junior high. And so ever since, I've went for it.
Does it seem like yesterday when you went out there for the first time to kick as an eighth grader?
Oh, yeah, I'd do it all over again. It's a great feeling.
What have you learned about yourself as a person doing this all through your high school years? Have you learned more about yourself than you thought you would?
I've learned that girls can do anything that they put their mind to, and actually not even just the fact that you're a girl or a boy. It's you can just who you are, you can do anything if you put your mind to it. And I've always went by the quote, a head full of fears has no room for dreams. So if you fear it, then there's no room for it. So you just got to put that to the side and face your fears and make your dreams come true.
You think of yourself as a role model?
I hope I am. I hope I've showed girls. I even had a girl here at my school. She's a, I think, 7th or 8th grader say, hey, I've always thought of playing football. I'm a pretty good soccer player. And I've told her, I was like, well, anything that you want to do, I can help you do it. I can teach you how to kick or anything, or even get my dad, who's taught me how to kick, to come out there and help. And I really hope I've drew her to do that.
So when you look at all the accolades and GISA awards and all that kind of stuff, the first time that you got an all-state recognition, what did that mean to you, and what did that mean to your family, and what did that mean to Coach Murdoch and everybody down there in Dawson?
Oh, wow. That was the first time that I was even named all-region or all-state. That was the absolute best feeling ever, coming from the fact that I'm a girl and I've got a title for myself playing a men's sport.
Okay, so then have you ever been in a situation, for those who haven't seen a Terrell Academy game, have you ever been in a situation where you've had to be that last person after a kickoff or a miss or anything like that? Have you ever had to be the person to knock the guy out of bounds to keep it from being a touchdown?
Yes, one time I've gotten out of the way because...
Wait, you got out of the way?
I did. There's been two times. I pushed him out of bounds because he was right there on the line. He was about to just fall out, so I just pushed him out. But the other time, I had to get out of the way because I was literally about to get myself knocked out. I'm 5'5", little girl, and this big dude was trucking it. I had to get out of the way.
And so what's the conversation like on the sidelines after that moment where it's you're the last person there? What's the conversation like after that play?
Well, after the play that I got out of the way, the whole team was saying that was a good choice because you were really about to get knocked over.
So what's, you know, you look at your career and you ask yourself, okay, so what's next? I guess that's the largest question in all of this. What's next for you? Are you looking to chase on the college level, or what's the plan here?
Well, I've had a few colleges look at me, and one in Illinois, and I think the other one was in Gulfport. And if I get something, I definitely will take it, whatever I get, maybe even walk on somewhere. I really don't even have my plans ready yet.
Because, you know, since I'm 900 years old, and I remember back in the late 90s, there was a kicker by the name of Tanya Butler. And she went to a high school here in the Atlanta area, and she was the first female kicker to score points in the Georgia Dome in a high school semifinal. Do you know what you want to do when you're 22, 23 years old? Do you know what kind of a major you're looking for colleges or things like that? What do you want to be when you grow older? Let's put it that way.
A marine biologist.
And how did that come to pass?
Honestly, I've just loved the beach, and I've always watched these movies when I was little about, you know, Dolphin Tale, and I've always grown up watching that, and every time I go to the beach, I just loved it.
And marine biology, I know that takes a lot of smarts. How do you balance your time when it comes to academics and athletics, and how difficult has that gone as you've gone later and later in school?
Well, it starts off with my mom. She's always on me to study, and that's helped a lot. That's helped my grades. It's helped me to just not be sidetracked all the time because I am ADD, and I easily just get off subject and all. So my mom's a big factor in that.
If I was to come back in 10 years and we were to have this conversation all over again, what will you carry with you from your high school years the most? Not necessarily just football, but what will you carry with you the most?
I'd carry with me the fact that I'd say my faith, and that you always just, no matter what happens, if you fail, you always get back up.
Well, Jenna, thanks for being a great role model. Thanks for being a great sport, and thanks for hanging out with us. And say hi to everybody down there at Terrell Academy and GISA All-State kicker, Jenna Cuff from Terrell Academy.
Thank you for having me.
That was Terrell Academy place kicker Jenna Cuff speaking with GPB's John Nelson. She is the first woman to be placed on the Georgia Independent Schools Association All-State football team. Their conversation is part of the Football Fridays in Georgia podcast. You can subscribe for free at gpb.org/podcasts. It is International Women's Day, and I will be moderating a panel of powerful women at GPB Atlanta tonight. One of them is educating girls and midwives in rural Afghanistan, another helping erode tolerance for domestic violence in Guatemala, and Abigail Disney. Yes, that Disney. She's a filmmaker, activist, and philanthropist who will also be there. Disney founded the nonprofit Peace is Loud, which is partnering with GPB, the Association of Junior League International, and Dining for Women on the event. It's going to be live streamed at gpb.org/women beginning at 7:30 Eastern Time. Beth Ann Holloman is president of Dining for Women. That's a network of giving circles with hundreds of chapters across the U.S., including several in Georgia. I spoke with her earlier about how Dining for Women is activating change agents one meal at a time. Beth Ellen, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So how did you come up with this format?
Well, it was very interesting. One of our co-founders, Marcia Wallace, started out with a birthday party in 2003. And instead of birthday presents, she requested that people make donations to a women's nonprofit called Women for Women International. And all the women at the birthday party were so excited that they decided they wanted to meet monthly. And then it started to grow from there.
So at these happen monthly, right? Monthly dinners?
Yes.
So
yes.
What kind of organizations do you fund?
We fund organizations that are bringing literacy skills to nomadic women. We fund a free primary school education and leadership training for rural girls in Afghanistan, reducing child marriage, gaining financial literacy skills. All of these issues affect a woman's ability to contribute equally to their community. And so we are trying to give them the skills and opportunities that will help them be equal contributors.
Well, here is a clip. This is from one NGO. It's called the Women's Justice Initiative, working to systematically chip away at domestic violence. This is an example of something that would be shown at these monthly dinners.
Aquí en Guatemala, pues la vida de una mujer indígena es muy difícil porque enfrenta varios problemas en su vida. Una de ellas, como por ejemplo, la violencia.
That is Elvia Rakek. She's talking about the particular challenges for indigenous women subject to long history of oppression in Guatemala, lack of opportunity and health challenges. Elvia is among the panelists tonight who will be there. She's from the Women's Justice Initiative. Tell us, Beth Ellen, a little bit about their strategy.
Their strategy is to systematically address community by community the issue of domestic violence by creating a culture that does not tolerate it in each of these communities. You know, one of the things that we find in working with women across the world is that one of the top things that women want to know is what their rights are as women. And so in Guatemala, Women's Justice Initiative has Indigenous women training Indigenous women about their rights and what to do if their rights are violated. And then they have advocates that if their rights are violated through, for example, domestic violence, they can have access to legal means to prosecute. And what this has done is created stigma in the community around domestic violence. And so by the very nature of doing the training and also having consequences, sometimes for the first time in the community for domestic violence, the domestic violence rate begins to decrease.
Another one of Dining for Women's grantees will be here tonight, Razia John. She is a true force of nature. She started a school for girls in rural village in Afghanistan. This is a place where the Taliban once ruled. She hasn't been yet featured, but she is a grantee. She's the subject of a documentary film, What Tomorrow Brings. Let's hear just a little bit from that.
When I opened the school the first year, I think was very tough. Some men came inside and said, please make it into a boys' school because the boys are the backbone of Afghanistan. They need this help. And I said, well, you know that the women are eyesight of Afghanistan. And I said, unfortunately, you all are blind.
This woman is fierce, and she's been so successful that they've started a college for midwives, which Dining for Women is funding. So what, Beth Ellen, does that connection do? You know, women working for justice in Guatemala or Liberia or Afghanistan and other places connecting with people having dinner in Utah or Missouri or Georgia.
It helps to create a feeling of community with the women of the world instead of a relationship of power. And that's what we really want to do, is to break down these feelings of the United States being the savior of the world. When women here in the United States see the brave and bold women around the world, they're also empowered to do things in their own lives. And so it's this feeling of reciprocation. I can give you an example of one woman in Illinois who, after seeing these women fight against domestic violence, learn how to read at age 35, to start businesses even when their community doesn't think that a woman can do it. She was then able to say, you know what, I never finished nursing school. I'm going back to nursing school. And she became a nurse in her 50s. We see examples of this here over and over again. It absolutely is a feeling of reciprocation.
Mm. How does somebody get involved?
They can go to our website, diningforwomen.org, click on start a chapter. It only takes about 4 people. You can be casual. You can be elegant. You can have it in a restaurant. It's very flexible for whatever lifestyle you have. I see it as a chance for people to get together with maybe those friends they don't see often enough and have social time with a purpose.
Beth Ellen Holloman, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Beth Ellen Holloman, she's president of Dining for Women. It's a giving circle with hundreds of chapters across the U.S. And we did hear from Elvia Rakek from the Women's Justice Initiative and Razia John from Razia's Ray of Hope, both Dining for Women grantees. I will be speaking with them and with Abigail Disney, filmmaker and founder of Peace is Loud, about their strategies and tactics for making change tonight at GPB. Dining for Women is one of the partners on the event. It will be live streamed at gpb.org/women beginning at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Well, that is our show for today. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, LaRaven Taylor, and Amelia Brock. Alec Caslow is our engineer, Don Smith, our dean of grammar, and Amy Kiley, senior producer. We always love to hear from you. We're on Facebook and we're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can email us at onsecondthought@gpb.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for spending some time with us. This is On Second Thought.